Good evening. It's, good evening. Anyone there? it's a great pleasure for me to be back at Greenbelt. I wasn't here last year because I spent a month in silence, but more of that later on. I thought I'd do a bit of talking this year. And exactly as Jill has said, I've just moved house. In fact, I haven't started my new job at Piccadilly, but I've been in my new house now for about 5 or 6 days, surrounded by crates and plumbers and movers, and it's been chaos. And the best bit so far, because I haven't started work, is that I sit there in my house on Piccadilly, surrounded by chaos, and I say to myself every day, you know what, it's like Piccadilly Circus round here. Because I'm quite slow, I think I'll say that every day to myself, and I will enjoy it. I'm between jobs, as you've just heard, so I have the luxury of being able to set off, as I will do after Greenbelt, on my bicycle for a few weeks. I'm looking forward to it immensely, although I'm also a bit nervous, because a few summers ago I did a long bicycle trip to Santiago de Compostela. Some of you may have heard me speak about it before. Whatever illusions I had when I was on my bicycle last time about finding inner peace as I pedalled down the back roads of France and across Spain, were shattered as I realised that whatever the tranquility of my surroundings, my head was full of noise. And that's really what I want to talk about this evening. Our sound is our wound. I'll explain that phrase a little bit later. But my head was full of noise. What was it full of? It was full of the rat-a-tat-tat of anxieties normally buried in a busy life in London. But my noise was tormenting me, particularly in one particular way, because in the 80s, I was a fan of the Smiths. I know they've come back. Morrissey particularly has come back. You'll remember Morrissey. He used to dance with a daffodil hanging out of the back pocket of his jeans. And the song which tormented me as I pedalled on my pilgrimage looking for inner peace was the wonderfully named Heaven Knows I'm Miserable Now. Why wasn't my head on the road filled with the Psalms, with Magnificats, with beautiful music? No, it was Morrissey and his daffodil and his teenage angst. Even for those of us who say we're not musical, researchers have found that there's a lot of noise going on in our heads, whatever our surroundings. Some of it's music, some of it is half-remembered conversations, things we wished we'd said. And there is a repetitiveness to this noise, and it torments us. But it's not just inside that perhaps we find we're tormented by sound. We live in a noisy world. This is a noisy festival. But has our world ever been this noisy? Lorries, cars, and trains thunder through towns and villages. Car stereos pump out bass beats, background music plays in shops and restaurants. But at the beginning of the 21st century, it became true for the first time in human history that more of the 6 billion people in the planet lived in cities rather than in the countryside. And it's this urban sound environment that has caused me to reflect a little on what it might mean for us as people. What does it reveal about us as people? And how does it affect our faith and our life? Particularly now, I guess, that I'm living right on Piccadilly Circus. A key expression of human sound is, of course, music. And I will say a little bit about music. But I want to say first that our relationship to music has changed in one or two fundamental ways in this century. And perhaps this is where we might veer off to the theme of this festival, the art of looking sideways. I want to suggest that in the way that we have changed our relationship with music, perhaps we are looking at the art of listening sideways. In contrast to previous centuries, our ability to record music makes a live performance in a concert hall available, audible, to many more millions of people than the ones who were there. Recording music in a studio means that mistakes can be removed, and so a technically perfect performance can be produced. It means that music itself becomes commodified, bought and sold like anything else. The very notion of beginning and ending music has changed too. The phenomenon of repeat to fade. when a song repeats over and over again the final chorus, has meant that musical endings and harmonic resolution is no longer necessary. Our relationship with music has changed too, in reaction to what I want to suggest is the largely hostile soundscape of the city. Thousands of people from every generation, not just young people, create our own soundtrack for life, walking around cities with an iPod, the telltale wires hanging down from our ears. Police officers, did you know, now have a phrase for such people who can't hear the traffic coming or can't hear the bleeping at a pelican crossing. These people, listening to music through earphones, distracted and liable to walk into the road at any time, are now called podestrians, unaware of the effect that they might be having on other people. We, unlike the vast majority of our forebears, have the capacity to listen to an orchestra alone. We're familiar, perhaps, with solitary performers, a folk violinist in the corner of a pub, a piper at a cemetery. But in previous centuries, you would have to be royal, like King Saul asking for David to play for him alone, or extremely rich to command a performance just for yourself. Now you can listen to the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra and you can be naked in your bath. The public oral environments that we share with other people on the street or in a shop or in a restaurant are full of extraneous noise over which we have little control. But perhaps in reaction to this, in our private lives, we've never had so much power over what we hear. In the performance of a very intense piece of music, classical or jazz or popular music, I sometimes experience musical sound which seems to be a wound, in that it expresses vulnerability, it expresses personal exposure simply for the sake of the music. There are clearly sounds that indicate the infliction of a wound, a cry of pain when a child falls over, for example, but I'm suggesting something slightly different, in that the sound itself is a wound and a signifier of something deeper, whether that be music, whether that be the contemporary urban environment, or perhaps whether it be the sounds that we make individually. Perhaps it would be more accurate to say that the sounds we make are audible scars of damaged tissue underneath, but the sound has substance in itself, in that its nature is that of a wound which reveals depth and truth under the surface. Wounds are truth tellers, and their scars link us to the past and provoke the telling of stories. My brother, for example, has a scar on his head when he ran into a wall as a small boy. I can still hear myself screaming into the garden for my mum as his face poured with blood. Visible scars from past wounds mark a person out, and depending on the severity of the wound, that person's identity can become almost wholly defined by one incident in their lives. A woman whose face was burnt in a fire 10 years ago walks around the supermarket and knows that the customers can tell she's had that experience. It's exposing, as she may rather be known first as a botanist or a grandmother. But a key and painful experience in her past is revealed to strangers, whether she likes it or not. Emotional or psychological wounds are harder to see and easier to hide. But part of our maturing as people and people of faith is that we learn to live with the wounds of our past. It can be precisely from contemplating and accepting those wounds that we begin to mend, and that we learn that it's never too late to begin again. So back to sound. In terms of the way in which I want to reflect on sound as a wound, it's important to draw a distinction. I want to talk about sound in two different ways. Sound is both actual and also a powerful metaphor. The physical sounds with which we live, including music, some inside us, some outside us, will form one aspect. No one knows the fragments of sounds that play inside our minds. Some psychologists have tried to explore the variety of internal sounds with which we live, linked to our memories, our dreams, or our emotional extremes. But in the end, no one knows except you. There are also actual sounds that many people hear and try to find vocabulary to describe our shared environment. But second, sound is also a powerful metaphor for describing our relationship with God. From the description of creation in Genesis and the beginning of John's Gospel, the action of God has been expressed in sound. Trying to describe the beginning of the earth's life, Jews and Christians have said that God speaks. Christians offer the metaphor of God as the eternal word. God therefore has a voice, but no one is suggesting that God has a larynx. All language we use about God is therefore metaphor, in the sense that God is beyond our description or language, even though we keep trying to use it. And perhaps because we can't see sound and God is invisible, the world of sound has proved a rich source of metaphoric descriptions of the presence and activity of God. John of Patmos, you remember, in the book of Revelation, heard a voice like the sound of many waters. And Ezekiel heard the still, small voice. In reflecting on this theme, I'm making the assumption that taking our own contemporary experience seriously is part of the Christian vocation. And so I want to spend just a few minutes now talking about the sound of lament in the world today. I visited a friend in hospital. She's in her early 40s and has been living a full life while managing a serious degenerative condition, which has required her to use a wheelchair for all of her adult life. After suffering a stroke, she'd been resuscitated by doctors who weren't sure enough of her wishes to let her go. As a result, she had very little control over the movement of any part of her body, but she remained acutely alert in her thoughts and emotions. As I pushed open the ward door to find her bed, I heard a terrible sound, which was something like a shriek, somehow more lacerating than a scream, a sound of rapier, pure anguish, an overwhelming sound that I've not heard before or since from a human being. A sound of fury, regret, and violent refusal to accept the present moment. I didn't want to believe that this sound was coming from my friend. I hoped it was someone else, someone I didn't know and would not have to face. But my heart pounded and my eyes pricked as, of course, I rounded the corner and saw what I didn't want to see, that it was her. The sound made me want to put my hands over my ears and cry for her to stop. But I circled the bed, feeling the heat of her pain and knowing that I would be burned by it too. The sound of lament. This sound of lament is heard throughout Scripture. It's much more than a cry of grief. It's more than a purely human reaction to a distressing event or oppressive situation. It's a protest against the pain of the present time and also a timeless expression of the weeping voice of God, in whose image and likeness we're made. This lament is contemporary, because in the midst of lament, all that exists is the pain of the moment, but it's also eternal, in that our lament joins the lament already begun before the ages by the blood of Abel crying for vengeance from beyond the grave. Human beings cry for the loss of life, for the loss of a future, for the loss of hope. In its power and precision, our personal lament lacerates the platitudes of well-meaning friends and expresses the paradox that in the midst of life, we know we're in death. The prophet Jeremiah tells us of Rachel, the one Walter Brueggemann calls the uncomforted mother who weeps for her lost children. An artist told me in conversation that he'd visited a convent once and talked with the sisters there about what Mary, mother of Jesus, would have done on the evening of Good Friday. They imagined together that she would have gone to visit the mother of Judas. And so the artist painted this scene. Two women, two uncomforted mothers, sitting talking together about their terrible day. The imagined scene of these two mothers sitting together after the death of their sons was reminiscent of another meeting, this time not of grieving, but of expectant mothers years before, the visit of a younger Mary to her cousin Elizabeth. If Elizabeth had lived to see her own son, John the Baptist, executed, the three would have had much to share on that first Good Friday. The uncomforted mothers of sons at the heart of the story of salvation. Echoes of these biblical imagined conversations were heard in July 2005, after the bombs had exploded underground and on the bus in central London. Not only victims' relatives were interviewed, but the mother of one of the bombers was asked to comment by a journalist. It was reminiscent for me of that imaginary meeting between Mary and the mother of Judas. She said in a television interview, "I do not know how to grieve for my son. Instead, I will grieve for the victims, for the dead and injured." Lament seems to have been a feature particularly of city life as early as the second millennium BC. The tradition of public lament was recorded over ruined cities and temples in southern Mesopotamia. And it's the tradition of urban lament that Jerusalem becomes the subject of the Book of Lamentations after the destruction of the temple in 587. In times of war and at moments of destruction or natural disaster, it's still the case in Western societies that days of official mourning are called and national memorial services are held. But the truth is that we have lost the tradition of lament. The fact of death is much less acknowledged publicly than in previous generations, and rituals of public mourning, the laying out of a body, the wearing of special clothes, the gathering of extended family, have for most people now translated into 3 days compassionate leave from work and attendance at a quiet funeral. In British cities like London, Birmingham, and Liverpool, where people from many cultures live, public mourning is still visible and audible from time to time. But collective national mourning after death has been formalised to the lying in state of public figures. In listening for the sound of urban lament today, it's not so much our reaction to physical human death that I want to suggest, as the qualities and characteristics of a society's lament in the face of deathly habits and structures. If an individual lament, like the one I described, is to some extent involuntary, visceral, a signifier of pain in vocal expression, then in a society where the tradition of formal, communal, and intentional lament has been lost, I want to suggest that lament takes the form of an involuntary expression of pain faced with the prospect of nothingness, a kind of socialized, politicized, collective lament. What do I mean by that? A modern urban soundscape is characterized by the qualities of relentlessness and monotone. I used to live in East London on a busy highway into the city, and the only times I witnessed the road fall silent was Christmas Day and the day of the funeral of the Princess of Wales. The low, insistent drone of cars, vans, and buses, it's very familiar to us, was constant throughout the day, punctuated by sirens of police cars, fire engines, the warning of the zebra crossing just outside the community centre where I lived. Away from the sounds of the street, we're surrounded by the manufactured sound environments when we enter shops, bars, restaurants, and the huge shopping centres in which we can easily spend days shopping and eating without even seeing the sky. The bigger department stores have their own radio stations with playlists to suit the type of customers they hope will buy the clothes. Thought's been given to the music they play, and the leakage of sound out of the door will often be in inverse proportion to the cost of the goods inside. In broad terms, loud indicates youth and inexpensive, quiet indicates wealth and class. We go about our everyday business largely unaware of this background sound. We rarely reflect on what we're experiencing, just as we won't often examine wallpaper in our bathroom. It's just normal life. But noting the sounds that we hear and what effect it has on us and on our spirit and on our emotions bears reflection and a little analysis. A short, regular trip to have a haircut reveals one type of manufactured sound environment when we stop to listen. I walk into a hairdresser, and the music, pulsating fast, is loud. As I walk through the door, the young male singer is singing about having sex with a woman he's just met. It's just loud enough for everyone to have to raise their voice slightly and has the effect of making you think you've arrived at a party. There is intimate touch here, from the young woman who washes my hair to the man who cuts it and reassures me in murmured professional tones that the grey is not really that visible. The oral environment creates a fantasy of youth, of social interaction with glamorous strangers, with a hint of danger and flirtatiousness. What is actually happening is quite functional. A row of standing people are, with scissors, cutting off the hair on the heads of another row of people who are sitting down. For most of the time, my hair's wet, plastered to the side of my scalp, and I look straight ahead at the mirror in front of me, thinking, blimey, she looks tired. After the functional hair cutting is over, there's an economic transaction at the till with some low-level beeping and some exchange of pleasantries, normally thank you about seven times, to cover the reality of money changing hands. Yet I invariably walk out of the hairdresser feeling better about myself than when I went in. The fantasy sound world has done its job. I somehow feel a little lighter and that perhaps more is possible. This particular manufactured sound environment is designed to sell haircuts and colour treatments. Presumably the theory is that creating the fantasy of a party will increase the confidence of the customers and make them feel as if they've joined a group of glamorous people a bit younger than themselves. While they undergo what is actually a fairly practical procedure, they experience, if only for an hour, the atmosphere of a kind of safe club. It's designed to encourage repeat visits, that is, to sell more haircuts. And so the music is chosen with the target clientele in mind. In a fast food restaurant, the lighting is harsh and the music slightly annoying, in the hope that customers will do what it says on the tin, eat fast and leave their table for someone else. The environment is not designed to make us linger. We're not aware on a day-to-day basis of the choices that other people have made as they surround us with sound. I want to suggest that the sounds of these artificial environments reveal the city's wound of relentless commercialism. We are surrounded by inducements to buy things, which make people in all their varieties into homogeneous customers, categorized only by our ability to pay. Although our experience of everyday sound is largely unacknowledged, we're consciously aware of the power of sound in some ways. One of the most heavily criticised developments in cities of 2008 was the placing of a device called Mosquito, which emitted a high-pitched tone only heard by people under 25. The device was designed to dissuade large groups of people under 25 from congregating outside shops and supermarkets. A campaign run by young people, appropriately called Buzz Off, attacked the use of this Mosquito device. And as a result of the protest, a number of companies and councils reduced its use. As a method of maintaining public order, it has its supporters who say it works. But as an articulation of how a civilized society regards its young people, it's an indictment of the adults. This sound is the wound of a society that seems to despise and fear its young. There's arguably no other group of people in society against whom this would be tolerated. The decisions we make about sound reveal our attitudes and our values. In the sounds of the street of a city, those that no one has coordinated or controlled, there are natural sounds which are masked by the all-enveloping noise. There are foxes, of course, not often heard except when they tip over rubbish bins. Birds are sometimes heard, but their song is different. There is something poignant about the song of birds in the city. I used to live next to the River Thames, and seagulls cry every morning. When I woke up, I could feel for a moment that I was by the sea. Memories of childhood days, snippets of memory, the smell of salt, the taste of ice cream, were triggered by the seagulls. Somehow, I took my childish innocence into morning prayer with me. The sound of birdsong in a city is changing. Because scientists tell us that bird bone structure and behaviour are close to dinosaurs, they are somehow, for me, as a non-biologist, the indigenous people of the skies, the descendants of pterodactyls, the survivors of the ages. And the interaction between birds and their urban environment reveals one aspect of the lament that we're listening for. Birds sing to find a mate, to mark out territory, to warn other birds of danger. They sing in spring, they sing as dawn breaks, and their song marks the passing of time and the seasons. But recent research has shown that birds sing differently in cities. While their ability to adapt to their environment is, of course, impressive, changes to their song are a warning to us. Like the canary in the mine, whose death warned miners of the presence of gas. Birds are warning us of the dangers we can't see. In cities, birds are singing not just in the daytime, but at night, in reaction not only to light pollution, but to noise too. A series of articles in the New Scientist magazine explored the findings at various universities who found that birds were singing songs more quickly and at a higher pitch than in nearby forests. Another study has shown that urban birds are singing more loudly too. Nightingales were recorded in Berlin in 2001, singing at 95 decibels, which is as loud as the New York subway. This necessity to sing so loudly may damage their lung function, it may send the evolutionary process in a new direction. But scientists continue to work on these studies, helping us understand the witness of the birds as they show us what effect our choices have not only on us, but on the creatures with whom we share our environment. What seems to be happening is that birds are singing more loudly, at a higher, shrill pitch, with less variation, and in the dark, in order to help make themselves heard. Night has become the new day. The urban world is inside out. We've begun to use the language of the natural environment to describe our sound environment. We now speak of noise pollution, and we know that sustained sound 24 hours a day is a contributing factor to high stress levels and illness. The business of leisure generates its own sound world too. Apart from the noise emanating from bars and restaurants, our desire for more television channels means that the tarmac is dug into to lay more and more cables to more and more individual homes more and more often. The desire of vast numbers of people to spend their leisure time surrounded by loud music whilst consuming high levels of alcohol is a clear strain on those who live around pubs and clubs. And so it seems we're entertaining ourselves into an early grave too. It is important to say, before I start sounding too much like a grumpy old woman, it is important to say that the all-enveloping sound of loud music in a club or a pub or at Greenbelt is great fun. And to dance to it is, of course, a great pleasure. But when I do it, I also recognise in myself that I'm enjoying a sense of escape rather than finding lasting satisfaction. So what does this urban sound environment I'm describing, what does it reveal about ourselves? Well, on an individual basis, of course, not much. The wall of sound that emanates from city centre pubs, for example, will be made up of 1,000 different voices. And each one could hardly be characterised as a lament. But as a collective wall of sound, it strikes a high-pitched note of energetic and anxious laughter, the competitive storytelling of colleagues trying to keep up, the over-eager downing of the first drink just to take the edge off. In volume and pitch, the city centre culture reveals a mixture of need and aggression that gives the sound of the crowd a poignancy more eloquent than the feelings of any individual. It's poignant, I want to suggest, because it's the sound of a society reassuring ourselves that we do not have to be alone, that the money we have is ours and we earned it, and that we should enjoy ourselves now because we're afraid of what's going to happen when we die. We're all part of the collective maintenance of values in society that put almost intolerable pressure on individuals to succeed, personally, financially, and socially. And it's this pressure that's temporarily relieved by the excesses of the weekend. And so we can't judge. There is no them and us. There is only us. While very few people would publicly defend assessing the value of human life purely in economic terms, our collective behaviour sometimes betrays our unacknowledged motives. Maximum gain for minimum effort. A search for self-worth in the therapy of retail. Stories of shopping crowds stampeding and in some cases trampling each other or shop staff, they appall us, but we don't find it all that surprising. Despite every world religion attempting to teach its followers to value what has no price, the fact is that even in the midst of the global downturn, not many people that I spoke to who worked in financial services predicted a truly fundamental shift in the values on which our competitive economic system is based, or in the methods by which those values are maintained. Many in financial services, if they kept their jobs, predicted a medium-term reduction in economic activity, a chastened financial sector, simply lending and trading less, followed by some kind of slightly pared-down business as usual. With the return to the bonus culture this year, perhaps this prediction is turning out to be true. The point is that in what sociologists are calling late modernity, our urban sound environment expresses something of our values and desires, and I'm suggesting our wounds too. In a market economy reliant on trade, delivering products more quickly than competitors has increased the volume, in both senses of the word, of traffic. In a society that equates privacy with status, still the majority of cars take only one person to work. The greater my disposable income, the more privacy I can buy, and the less time I have to wait for anything. While those who are poor or elderly queue at a bus stop, people who are rich have a car waiting outside the meeting. Our capacity to do more, to generate more, to spend more is a symbol of our power. And we make a lot of noise while we're doing it. A children's story tells of a Native American walking down a street in New York City. He turns to his companion and says, "What a beautiful sound that cricket is making." "I can't hear it above all the traffic," says his guide. "How can you hear it?" "It all depends what you're listening for," says the Native American. As he says this, he takes a coin from his pocket and drops it on the pavement. 100 heads turn towards the sound of loose money. The desert fathers and mothers identified a spiritual malaise described in Psalm 91. It's the pestilence that stalks by noonday. Acidy, or acadia, is a spiritual listlessness akin to boredom or exhaustion, and it strikes not during the dark night of the soul, but in the daylight. This spiritual listlessness and low energy strikes when the sun is high and the light is strong, when we're busy and active and working hard. For businessmen and women, for overworked social workers, probation officers, teachers, call centre workers, street cleaners, shift workers, we have created a cityscape of perpetual noonday, of 24-hour helplines and all-night burger bars, and we wonder why our spirits are low. In the ancient world, a rhythm of fasting and feasting was connected to the rhythm of the earth, or to large-scale events and disasters. But in a never-ending feast without a fast, living in a day without night, in light without darkness and noise without silence, our lament takes a different form. It's hidden, unacknowledged, and involuntary, but audible for those who want to listen for the signs of the times. There are those in our cacophonous society who say that the sounds of religion should be silenced too, that religious observance is essentially personal and should remain exclusively private and doesn't warrant a place in the public square. Public religious observance depends not only on words, but on symbolic sounds. The argument that religion doesn't deserve a place in the public square depends on the postmodern reflection that individuals believe a whole set of things not expressible in the communal doctrines imposed by an authoritative religion. To some extent, this is true and has always been so. In any given congregation of people who've gathered to worship, there will be a great variety of convictions. Many people who attend a Christian funeral will believe in their heart of hearts that reincarnation is a serious possibility. Others will believe down, deep down, that despite what the church says in its funeral rites, there probably isn't any existence after we die. There'll be a whole variety of what people believe in any given set of circumstances. But symbolic sounds are often more powerful than any set of words. For example, 2 weeks after the bombings in central London of July 2005, the Mayor of London declared that at midday there would be 2 minutes silence. At St Paul's Cathedral, where I was working at the time, a bell was tolled in the minutes leading up to 12 noon. Cars pulled over, taxis and buses stopped their crawl up Ludgate Hill, and thousands of office workers poured out of the buildings and began to gravitate towards the cathedral. The bell was a public sound onto which each person presumably projected their own thoughts and feelings. In a public act of commemoration, some people were able to express the feelings, the difficulty of expressing what the different reactions that they'd had to that terrible act of terrorism. The ancient sound of the tolling bell called thoroughly modern city workers away from their desks. The Christian church, then, has a historic role expressed in that story, to call people into silence in the presence of God. It's a role that has particular meaning at the time of tragedy, but given society's increasing noise, as I want to argue, I think it has more contemporary urgency and focus in today's world. But in order to fulfill this role, the churches, we have to practice silence in order for others to have something to join. Much is written and ironically said about intentional silence in the church. One of the best loved descriptions of God in Scripture, popularized in the well-known hymn, as I mentioned at the beginning, is the still small voice, more recently translated as the sound of sheer silence. But often, when we church people talk about silence, we're often not expressing so much a deep yearning for stillness in which we may commune with God, as a distaste for vulgar noise and a desire for peace and quiet, in the same way as a Victorian rector retreated into the study when the children played too loudly. We often don't mean real silence. We mean the right kind of noise. In a world of constant noise, church communities can teach themselves to be oases of silence and stillness, witnessing to a different reality, one that doesn't need endless distraction and clamour to communicate it. As we explore the theme of silence in our own lives, it's a pertinent challenge, particularly for someone who lives in a city, to keep a sound diary, just as those wanting to lose weight keep a food diary. What are the sounds that you hear in a day? How much do you hear, and what do you feel about it? How much music is in your life? What kind of music is it? Is there any silence? How do you feel when there is? What sounds are going on in your head? Are there snatches of conversation or bits of tune? Are there inexplicable or unidentifiable noises, or is there nothing? All of this is relevant for people of faith who want to find ways to listen for the presence of God, not in terms of hearing physical voices, but in the discipline of discernment, a desire to align our will with the will of God. Learning about our attitudes to noise and silence will assist in our attempts to become more and more attentive to the presence and the will of God deep within us and present and active in our society. Silence itself is not straightforward. It's not neutral. It's not just the absence of noise. There is, of course, the silence of the silenced, the silence of the unmarked graves of the disappeared, what the medieval mystic Hildegard characterized as satanic silence, the silence of the fallen angels. But a shared silence, such as that of a Quaker meeting, or the purposeful remembering of someone who has died, or such as the contented silence of long-time companions who don't need to make conversation, is a different proposition. A silence that's underpinned by love, by a willingness to wait, by a level of attentiveness that accepts who we are and where we are now. This is a gift that the churches can give to our distracted world. The church's wounds are on display when we're unable to be silent or to invite others into a kind of silence. And so finally, what is the church's role in this noisy society? Perhaps it is to cultivate our own appreciation of silence, to call others into it. Are we, as Christians, a body of people whose instinct is to fall into the silence of waiting on God? Are we a body of people who are at peace with our own death? Are we a body of people whose visceral compassion for the suffering world is expressed in our tone of voice and in what we do and what we say? Are we a body of people who know the language and music of lament, who have learned to sing out our own pain? Are we a body of people whose worship of God is in tune with the songs of the angels rooted in the groans of the earth? Jesus of Nazareth cried with a loud voice to raise Lazarus from the dead. He did not remain silent in the midst of torture and is forever in the presence of the music of the angels in eternity. Jesus also seemed to need silence often. From this attentive inner silence, we're able to speak, catching the echo of the voice of God as we've heard it from the beginning. There is a cost to speaking with this accent, as it will associate us, as Peter's accent did on the night of Jesus' arrest, with the one crucified by frightened and violent men. We will often confront in the silence, as Peter did, our own capacity for betrayal and cowardice. But when, like Peter, we've heard Christ's words of restoration, we will, I want to suggest, precisely from our greatest failure and our deepest fear, we will acknowledge our need for forgiveness and start again to help to change the world. Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much, Lucy, for giving us lots to think about. We have a few minutes, so if what Lucy said has raised questions in your mind, then do come down to the front and I'll pass you the mic and you can ask Lucy some questions. We run here until 7, so 10 minutes if you have questions. If you'd need to leave now, would you leave through the exit on that side so you can be counted out? Anybody? Okay, we have a question, Lucy.
Hi, I was just wondering about for music and if there are some situations where music could express some sort of communion with God and other times when the same music could be noise, and whether there are some times where music is appropriate for a certain time. Yeah.
Thank you.
The same music could perform different functions, I mean, in different situations. I think it can. There's a composer who's been at Greenbelt actually before called John Taverner, who when you talk to him about how he composes music, he's amazing because he's adamant that it simply arrives and the music comes to him. There's no craft involved. So what he says is that the composer's intention doesn't matter in the composition of music. Other composers say that the composer's intention is really vital in that process. So they're given inspiration, but their own craft and what they've learned to put into the music is important. So I think certainly some music in different situations can be a way of communicating with God, and other times it can be a barrier. And one thing that's very interesting about silence is that if you spend time in silence, it becomes not exactly noise, but it's not the absence of noise. It becomes something of itself. It has a substance of itself. So it's a paradoxical subject in itself. Sometimes if you're in a club and the music is a kind of wall of sound, that can in itself produce a funny kind of silence. You can kind of go through that repetitive music to find silence.
Lucy, you were talking about the fact that birds in cities now seem to actually be having a much larger song. I don't know whether you actually saw an article in the paper last week about the good people of Cheltenham and the problems that they're actually having with seagulls. And there are some in the population who feel that they should be shot. Now, only certain seagulls could be shot, because there's one particular type, and I can't remember which one, which is actually protected, so you can't shoot it. But that is going on in Cheltenham. Mm.
I mean, the point I was trying to make about birds is that I think it's a real tragedy. I mean, it's an adaptation. So in some senses, you can say that it's clever of them. But I can't help feeling a sense of loss, that birds are singing more in monotone at a shriller pitch and having to sing more loudly over the noise that we have created. I think there's variety is lost, and I myself kind of feel a sense of loss about that. So I think I was trying to contrast the natural sounds of the birds. And I mean, certainly having lived with seagulls, they can be really very annoying.
I was interested by what you were saying, Lucy, about sound expressing a wound. Having been a music therapist for 10 years, we work directly with that wound through music. And then you were speaking about the urban soundscape. And I wondered if there was a way of working with that sound to engage with the wound. Mm.
Yes, I suppose, I mean, one of the things that I'm trying to describe is something that I'm listening for, I suppose, or hearing. And it seems quite overwhelming because the values that are producing this sound are ones that we all seem to be buying into. So what I'm hearing is a kind of relentlessness and a monotone in a city that is in itself an expression of pain. Or what I would want to suggest is a fear of death. That if we kind of, it's a bit like in a forest, you know, all the beasts are out there in the dark, so you light a fire and you bang the dustbin lids together to keep the things that you're afraid of away. And it seems that there's something about that that's coming from our fear. I suppose what I'm trying to suggest as far as Christians is our reaction to that. We've got personal things we could do. But I think as churches, there is a role for us to play as communities. And what I'm suggesting is that we cultivate silence within that environment of sound, or that we pay attention to the sounds that we're making, and we know which are our wounds, and we have a commitment to beauty, and that there is some kind of way that we can listen hard to those sounds of the relentlessness and the monotone, and try not to let our churches become mirrors of that sound, walls of relentlessness and busyness and overactivity. Thank you. Music therapy, that's a very fantastic point. Yeah, thank you.
Not quite the point I came up to ask about, but the Observer Book of Birds doesn't list a single species of seagull. It only lists gulls. The association of gulls with the seaside, it's quite an artificial one, so right. The seagulls have as much right to be in Cheltenham as Cheltonians. Thank you. No, what I was going to say is something that I've noticed is the noise, the chatter that goes on in my own head, or the trivia. I find it's dangerous for me to watch soap operas. I caught an episode of Holby City earlier this week, and you know, particularly with medical dramas, you know, because of all the imminence, the peril, the emotions are very much heightened. So kind of lying in bed afterwards, I had kind of what I'd been seeing on the screen chattering away with myself. And something that I've found very helpful, actually, in that situation where I'm trying to wind down in bed at night, is the Jesus Prayer. Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me, a sinner. Mm. And it's something to do with the content of that, but also the repetition, just kind of blocking out that noise, that meaningless chatter, with something consistent, something meaningful, and something tranquil. And, you know, that's actually a sound that I'm actually putting there out of choice, but it's replacing the wounding noise.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Last two questions.
Hi, I was thinking about like contemporary music in churches today, and how some of it can be quite loud, and you have worship bands. Like I went to church recently, and they had a screen up for the drummer because it was all loud. And I was wondering what's your thoughts on if as churchgoers we want to sort of provide a relief from this sound as a wound. When you have types of music like that, where do you draw the boundaries? Like, where does it become, you know, a way to celebrate, and where does it, you know, sort of, where is it a continuation of that sound as a wound? And just wondering what you thought about sort of different musics and where the boundaries lied.
That's an excellent question. I think, I absolutely love loud music. That's, you know, well, I wouldn't say that very strongly. And I'm, you know, very keen on turning the stereo up just as much as anybody else. I suppose what I'm saying is that it's like a feast. It's like constant feasting. There's no fasting. So if I were thinking about what happens on a Sunday morning in church, then there would be one of the things that you can think about is how much silence is there? What's the level of sound in an hour and a half? And is there a moment when you think, I mean, you don't want to overplan it, but is there a moment when you think, okay, we're really going to go for it there. We're going to have a lot of noise and, you know, that would be great. But the worst thing that worship leaders say is, we're now going to have a few moments of silence. Thank you, God, for X, Y, Z. And you just think, oh, was that it? Was that the moment of silence? And I suppose what I'm saying is that It's incumbent upon worship leaders with congregations to teach ourselves not to be afraid of silence and not to be afraid of quietness. Because you can bet also, if you're in church with children, as soon as the person at the front says, we'll have a few moments of quiet, everyone starts yelling immediately. And it's so stressful for parents. You know, it becomes a really terrible thing and everyone's kind of not wanting it. And so I think it takes years to cultivate a church community or congregation to be comfortable with silence. And, you know, there are ways that you can increase it each week or you have it before the service or whatever it is. But it's a question of planning it. So by all means, absolutely, full blast ahead, screen for the drummer, etc. But if 40 minutes out of 70 minutes are that's too loud, isn't it? Thanks.
Last one.
Hi. It's a question that was sort of... Okay, yeah. It's a question that was triggered by the music therapist, really. I have a godson who is the middle of three children. He has Asperger's syndrome and therefore has some communication difficulty. His older sister is very severely autistic. His younger sister is pretty severely autistic. But the difference between the oldest and the youngest is that the oldest has no sound that is particularly human, and she has no musicality, whereas the youngest one actually can hear a tune and even hold a note. And it's a number of times sort of got me reflecting on what is God saying to us through the voices that he has given us. Because with autism, there's no readily obvious wound. It is something about creation in diversity. And I'd just be interested to hear your reflections on what that tells us about God.
I mean, I mentioned a little in the story that I was telling about visiting my friend in hospital, but I think if we accept that we are made in the image of likeness of God, that's all of us without exception. All of us are made in the image of likeness of God. So when we express ourselves, that is expressible within the Godhead. And there isn't anything that is unacceptable in that, in God, as it were, in God's sound. And I mean, it's even difficult to say that God makes a sound. God is sound. There is nothing except God, as it were. Sound is inside God. So in practical terms, I think music therapists would have a lot more to say about this profitably than me, but it's about, I believe, it's about cultivating our ability to listen with everything that we have. There's a brilliant percussionist called Evelyn Glennie, who many of you will know, who has a hearing impairment. She can't hear anything with her ears. She talks a lot. She echoes a lot of what Hildegard of Bingen said in the 12th century, which is that we listen with our whole bodies. We hear rhythm, and we've lost the capacity to do that. We think listening is just with our ears. But it's about becoming attentive and aware and sensitive to one another, which will in itself actually wound us, because we will become then much more vulnerable to the loud sounds and the difficult sounds that we hear. But I believe that, you know, in terms of all our expression, that is something of the eternal Word, which is Jesus, which is before the beginning of creation and, you know, to the end of time. All the sounds that we make are caught up in the sound of God.
Thank you very much, Lucy. You've given us so much to think about, so much to share with one another during the weekend as we go out and speak and listen to one another. Let's thank Lucy again.
Thank you.